and welcome aboard the Battleship Pretension. I am Tyler Smith.
I'm David Beck.
Thanks.
I forgot that I usually say my last name. We've only been doing this 11 years.
Yeah. Like, I'm used to a very specific timing. As you heard, I just started going right into it. Oh, boy.
Okay. So what's your next line? Actually, I'm David Bax.
And thank you for listening, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Then, David.
Yes.
Bax.
Yes.
How you doing?
Well, can't you tell? Listeners, can you tell how we're doing? Can you hear? Can you hear how we're doing?
What if they can't?
I think they probably can.
Let's hope so.
Even though we've complained about it more than only one listener ever said anything, and it was after we acknowledged
it.
But yeah, we were unhappy with the echo in the new studio, which is not really that new anymore. It's been months. We finally got the sound paneling and the rug that we swore we were going to get. So thank you for bearing with us. Again, no one complained.
And let's hope that it is making any difference at all. Thankfully, it wasn't
super expensive. In the sound check, it sounded like it was...
It sounded okay.
Yeah.
That's why I had us do two sound checks, just so I knew.
Okay.
All right. It was worth the money. It was worth the $3,500 we paid on this stuff.
Yeah, move that decimal point a couple places to the left. But speaking of money, though, what pays for all this stuff?
Oh, my gosh.
Our sponsors, that's who.
Indeed.
And listeners like you, I guess.
Not like
you.
Me?
No, I'm talking to
shit.
Listeners like you.
Okay.
You can donate, you can buy our premium content, which is how we prefer it.
And I guess we should announce in a few weeks... We are going to have another round of commentaries available. It is going to be the first four Harry Potter films.
Yeah, for those of you who might be listening who don't know the layout here, two times a year we get a bunch of friends together. Tyler and I watch movies for hours straight and have our friends cycle through and watch them with us, and we record commentaries, and then you can buy them, and it helps support the show, and it gives you something fun to listen to. So yeah, our 2018 plan is to do all eight Harry Potter movies. We're doing the longer four first.
This is going to be the long, including when we did Lord of the Rings, like not the extended ones, thankfully.
Right.
Like, this is going to be the longest we've ever recorded for. This is going to be 10 and a half to 11 hours.
It's
going to
be so exciting. And yeah, you can find that. Tyler will get it up as soon as he recovers. It'll be up by the end of April, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, undoubtedly.
Okay. So that's something to look forward to. But yeah, day to day, who pays the bills?
Exactly,
around here.
Exactly. They punch in, punch out.
Uh-huh.
This episode is brought to you by MUBI, a curated online cinema that brings its members a handpicked selection of the best independent, international, and classic films. Every day, MUBI's curators introduce a new title, and you have 30 days to watch it. That means there's always 30 wonderful films to enjoy, all for only $8.99 a month. Plus, when you use their mobile apps, you can download films to watch offline. All right, so as we've mentioned before. Philippe Garrel's Lover for a Day was distributed at various places through the country, distributed by MUBI. It is now available on MUBI, streaming exclusively there, and so they are presenting the other films in Philippe Garrel's Trilogy of Love, Jealousy, and In the Shadow of Women. So all three of these movies are available now. Each is shot in gorgeous black and white and perfectly captures the anguish, beauty, and complexity of love. And then there's also a special offer for listeners of Battleship Pretension. You can try MUBI free for a month. Just go to MUBI.com. That's MUBI.com/battleship to redeem now, or go to BattleshipPretension.com and click on the MUBI ad.
And I want to tell you about TweakedAudio.com, which is where you go for professional quality earbuds in a variety of stylish styles and colorful colors. They look great. They sound great. Tyler and I each use them, separate pairs. We don't share a pair, each and every day of our lives. Today on my TweakedAudio.com earbuds,
okay.
Have you heard about, there's a on Spotify, a comp EP playlist thing called Universal Love. It's a LGBT benefit thing.
Oh, okay.
And it's artists you've probably heard, well, not you, Tyler. Well, you've heard of some of these artists.
Okay.
Doing love songs to the same sex as them.
Oh, okay.
Basically, you've got some of them are cover, some of them are new. You've got Saint Vincent doing "And Then She Kissed Me." That's fun.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Oh, you wouldn't know. Saint Vincent is a woman.
Okay.
Didn't know that.
It's gonna be like somebody did not get.
Yeah. You've got Benjamin Gibbard doing "And I Love Him," and you've got Bob Dylan doing a song called "He's Funny That Way."
All right. I've heard of him.
Yeah, that's.
And I saw him in
concert.
Oh,
you might have heard of Kesha. Kesha's on here.
I've heard of.
You've heard of Kesha.
Her?
Yes, you've heard of her.
All right.
Yeah, she does a song called "I Need a Woman to Love." So anyway, That's just what I was listening to, and it all sounded terrific on my TweakedAudio.com earbuds. They're available at a low, low price at TweakedAudio.com, but if you use the offer code PRETENSION at checkout, you get one-third off that low, low price and no shipping charges. So go to TweakedAudio.com and use the offer code PRETENSION.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Now.
Yes.
That's enough fucking around. It's time to get to our guest.
I don't think our sponsors would appreciate being described as fucking
being
around.
Characterized as fucking around. No, but we were fucking around before that.
That's true. Yes.
And I want to get to our guest. I forgot to ask her how she'd like to be introduced, but luckily I found her title here in the email. So from Collider.com, the senior editorial producer of Collider Video, Perry Nemiroff.
I'm glad that I emailed you last with my new fancy email signature.
Yeah,
my title changed recently.
A whole nother
mishmash of fancy sounding words.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, welcome to the show. Thank you
for
being here.
I'm so happy. I feel like we've been talking about doing this for a very, very long time.
Well, yeah, because there was a time that I used to see you at Comic-Con every year.
Only Comic-Con, yeah.
Because you didn't live here.
Yep. I was in New York.
Yeah. And then you moved here, what, less than 2 years ago?
Exactly 2 years ago,
okay.
In 3 days of this recording.
Oh, okay. Well, okay.
I was really excited for a moment.
But now I feel weird that I
April
know, like...
8th. April 8th was the official move-in date.
Yeah, I feel like I shouldn't have known... I shouldn't have been that close. It makes me feel weird. But I guess I'm counting backwards from Comic-Cons.
I feel like I figure everything in my life out based on either a convention, a film festival, or just when a movie was released.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
It's probably about, yeah, I can see that.
I used to, I mean, for a long time, it was based on jobs or apartments. Mm. But I've been in the same apartment now for... going on 8 years, and I've been not in the same position but at the same workplace for 7 years, so now it has to be things like Comic-Cons and whatnot. But that's neither here nor there. Thank you again for being on the show.
Thank
I'm glad we finally made
me.
It happen.
Yeah.
How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. Very, very, very busy, which is why this took long to schedule. It was pretty much all my fault.
Yeah, because we're just sitting around.
Yeah. We just kind of just like powered down when the show is off, and we just stay here.
At least you have some cats to maybe keep you company if they come out.
They're around, you know, when they want to be fed.
So I'll start just by asking the questions that I always ask people when they first come on the show. Where are you from?
I am from Long Island, New York. I grew up in the same house in the same neighborhood that my father grew up in. So we went to the same high school and everything. And then I never left New York. I moved to New York City and I stayed there. And I thought I was going to stay there for my entire life. But here I am.
And I'm assuming work brought you out here?
Yep. Collider relocated me so I could work in the studio here rather than just doing junkets and writing in New York. So once video became the top priority for me, it was kind of a no-brainer that I should be out here. I think the bigger decision was, would I actually have the guts to pick up and move?
Yeah.
And I'm still, to this day, shocked that I ever did.
So
I was going to ask, I have to assume it's fairly heartbreaking to leave this place that not only your family is such a big part of, but also your plan was to live there the rest of your life and then die there. And then if you had children, they would also live in the same house.
That actually pretty much sums up exactly what my plan used to be.
Yeah.
My whole family is still in New York. And after I graduated undergrad, I went to grad school, film school in New York City. And every single person, when we graduated, everyone's like, all right, I'm out of here. I'm moving to LA. I'm going to start my career. I'm like, hey, there is a film industry here in New York. We will all be fine. Just stay here with me. Everybody left. And eventually I was like, oh, you know, maybe I should. And now that I'm here, thinking back to my mind frame then, what was wrong with me? There is so much more opportunity. Not that you can't do it in New York, but there is so much more opportunity out here.
New York seems like the type of place that... Okay, if you live almost anywhere else in the country, maybe even in the world, and you say, I was born here and I'm going to die here, people will be like, come on. But New York, I feel like people are like, hey, that's great. Look at you.
There's also the beauty of Manhattan versus Long Island. Every single year I ever lived in the city, if I ever got sick of it, if it got too crazy, too much, all I had to do was hop on the LIRR and go back out to my parents' place. And I had a little breather for the weekend. So I kind of had the best of both worlds living there.
We know that Los Angeles is an acquired taste. It took me about a year and a half. I've heard people say as long as 3 years. Some people never like it. You're at a 2 year mark. I feel like you're at the point where you should maybe have a point of view. Do you like Los Angeles?
I like Los Angeles very much. I think I was a little spoiled when I moved here, though, because I was really nervous about leaving New York overall, but I thought I was going to miss New York City more, and it's mostly just the friends and family that I miss now. Hmm. I moved to a street with some things that were walking distance from my apartment, which I think was very, very important for me. Because I was also living dead smack in the middle of Times Square. Oh, so I had everything I could ever imagine 24/7 right outside my door.
Greta Gerwig in Miss America. Right?
Exactly. Everything was just going 24/7, and I really could just get food, anything. Here, that is not the case.
Yeah.
But at least I can walk outside my door. I can walk to a movie theater. I can walk to, maybe a dozen restaurants, Starbucks. So the fact that I had that made me feel like I wasn't locked into some sort of, middle of nowhere suburban area where I had to drive a car everywhere.
I totally know what you mean. Here in North Hills, I can walk to a Denny's. After a certain time, a Denny's, a 7-Eleven, and a couple of strip clubs. So
yeah,
I know exactly, I have what I need.
The key there is a 7-Eleven, though.
Yeah.
I will say the one thing that I miss so much about Manhattan that you don't have, two things actually, that are very hard to find in LA is, one, a good diner. There's really not very many good diners. And I'm not talking about some sort of weird spin on a diner. A classic diner where you can get scrambled eggs in the middle of the night or a grilled cheese at any hour of the day, and it's super greasy and amazing. No good diners. And then also, there's no corner stores with a deli counter. That's kind of what a 7-Eleven is for me here.
Yeah, when we lived in Chicago, there were a number of diners. I remember, was it every Thursday that we would walk to get groceries, and then stop off at that place whose name was not on the outside of the,
which I loved,
which was great. Yeah, it had a name, but I didn't know what it was.
Yeah, but that was a Chicago thing a New York thing too, where the diners are mostly owned by Greek families, and so you can get a lot of great Greek food at a diner. Which I've talked very recently in the podcast about how I've discovered that the equivalent here in Los Angeles is the place that is secretly a Korean restaurant.
Yes.
I just there's places, there's one in Burbank on Olive. There's a sub shop that also has great barbecue beef. There's a burger place practically across the street from here. I've talked about this a lot on the podcast.
That's
but it's
so
a,
random.
It's a thing that because I get a lot of Koreans end up being Korean families own these eateries, and they brand themselves as one thing that's sort of typically an American lunch type of thing, but then they also make their food on the side, so you can also get great Korean food.
Clearly I have not explored nearly enough in my 2 years out here.
Now are you, you mentioned that you came from Burbank. Do you live in Burbank?
Yes, I do. Oh,
sorry, that's a weird thing to ask. I apologize.
I try.
What street do you live on?
The Burbank bubble is a really big bubble. It'd be difficult to figure it out.
Right at Bob Hope Airport. What I was going to ask is, have you been to Coral Cafe?
Coral Cafe? What is this?
It is 24 hours. It's not necessarily a diner vibe.
Okay.
Part of it is. But the other part is just kind of a standard,
like a family restaurant.
It seems like a family restaurant until, you're there at 2 a.m. and you hear a loud noise, and a guy stumbles in, and he drunkenly had in his car burst through like their outer wall in their patio area, came in and said like, all right, just give me a bill for that. And then he sat down and ordered food. And but yeah, it's
also supposedly haunted, the Coral Cafe.
I've heard that.
That makes me want to go there even more.
You can find YouTube videos showing ghosts on the security footage or whatever.
Oh,
yes,
you mentioned that and I don't remember, but yeah. And so, and they have a very extensive menu. I can't guarantee that everything on that menu is good. They have pizza. I'd say avoid it.
It's not all supposed to be good.
Exactly.
That's the thing about a diner is they give you pages and pages in a menu, and then you just know. Like, you don't even need to look at that giant menu. You just know what you need at 2:00 in the morning.
Yes. Right. Coral Cafe.
Coral Cafe.
I highly recommend it.
I'm not going to forget that. I am going to look that up.
It's good stuff. It's on, I believe it's on.
It's on Burbank Boulevard.
It's on Burbank, yes. Yeah.
Okay, okay.
Anyway, that's enough recommendations. We already talked Valley Living and Valley Eateries before we started recording.
That's true.
Right?
Yes. And you told an embarrassing story about me.
It's not that bad.
It wasn't that bad, actually.
There was some sense to that decision.
All right, but that's enough of a tease. Yeah, so I was going to say something about Los Angeles. I forgot what it was. Maybe we'll come back to it. Let's talk about you as a movie fan. Obviously, you like movies. That's
quite a bit.
What you seem to have, you know, devoted your life to.
Yeah, pretty much.
When did that start? Did you have an older sibling? Were you a weird lonely kid like I was? Or?
I had parents and grandparents who let me watch whatever I wanted, whenever I wanted. So I grew up watching certain things way too young. I remember I was very young when Batman Returns came out. I remember growing up with the fear of the Penguin. But whenever I was scared of something, I was always excited by that fear, if it makes any sense. It's like most kids, when they're lying awake at night and they're hiding under the covers and they can't sleep, that's a terrible thing for some weird reason. I got a thrill out of it, which is why I love horror movies. But Jurassic Park changed everything. We're talking about it a lot at Collider right now because we were doing a top 10 Spielberg list video series. Mm-hmm. And Jurassic Park is my favorite Spielberg movie. It's my favorite movie of all time. And it was the very first time I can remember in my life processing the value of movie magic and how special it is to be fully consumed by a movie and have this crazy concept feel so real and exciting. And ever since then, it wasn't just about going to the movies and having fun. It was being able to have fun with the story that I was enveloped in, but also having an appreciation for this incredible craft that can transport you like that.
Spielberg is that filmmaker. Like, for me, it's not my favorite movie anymore. It's like my third, but Jaws was that for me. Like,
solid choice.
Just and for some it's Raiders, for some it's E.T. Like, just he is. This is gonna sound insulting. I don't mean for it to. Like, he's where a lot of film fans start.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And then from there they branch out. That's not to say they get past him, because chances are you circle back around and realize, like, oh shit, on top of being like a really good entry point into filmmaking, he's a damn good filmmaker on top of everything
he's
else.
Still doing good stuff. I mean, I haven't seen Ready Player One, but The Post was great, I thought.
I liked The Post quite a bit. And I did see Ready Player One. Did you see Ready Player One?
I did see it.
What'd you think?
I liked it. I liked it a lot. I didn't love it. I liked it a lot. Had a lot of fun with it. I'm also a book reader, too, and it's a difficult one not to compare to the book. There's certain elements that I'm being a big fat baby about, where I'm like, oh, you got rid of that thing that I love so much. You can't do this in 2 hours and 20 minutes, what he achieved in that whole book. But if you had to condense that book into one movie, into one single adventure, I think he did a pretty damn good job.
Do you think it would be an interesting miniseries?
I was thinking about that, because I think the only way you could really hit the same level of character development and world building that Ernest Cline did is if you did either a franchise or a TV series. Yeah. I mean, 2 hours and 20 minutes just isn't enough.
I do think that I don't have a lot of experience with the book. I've heard, frankly, like more negative things, and I did like the movie more than I thought based on that. But certainly, it's high concept, but because it is a world of just really endless possibilities, like, it could be a whole series.
Mm-hmm.
If a network was ambitious enough. And I think I wouldn't rule it out. It's something that could happen in the future. It would require a lot of money.
I wouldn't mind if they did that. I mean, it is pretty successful at the box office at this point in time. It had an okay opening weekend, and I think at the international box office, it made a really good chunk of change.
Yeah, I think it did better domestically. I think it did better than people expected. Yeah. Like people were saying, like, it's not going to be. They didn't say it was going to be a bomb, but it was not going to perform super well. And then it surprised some people.
I think word of mouth actually helps. And the South by Southwest premiere was probably a smart move.
Yeah, because it seemed like there was, with the ad campaign and stuff, there was a lot of skepticism from people like me, especially. And I do think that the positive reactions from even some people who had been skeptical on Twitter at South By really, I think, helped. I still haven't seen it, but I will someday. But I want to go back to Jurassic Park because you said some things that really that I really agree with. I've long been an advocate because I fell in love with movies, you know, in the basement in the middle of the night on VHS. Like, I'm a solo movie viewer, but I think one of my earliest memory of, like, oh wow, seeing a movie in a theater with a lot of people adds something, you know, or is a different experience. And it was a horror type moment. One of my favorite film going memories is being a kid. I was in middle school or whatever when that came out. And, the scene when they're from the lobby, they're climbing up into the duct and Lexi's leg is dangling. The velociraptor, it's Lexi, right?
Lex.
The velociraptor like jumps and almost gets her leg. Mm-hmm. And it's the entire theater like jumping, like screaming and jumping at the same time is like a crystal clear movie memory in my mind. And it's one of the reasons that I'm not like a horror person the way that I think you are. But if I had to pick a genre of movies that I could only watch that movie for the rest of my life, like a genre,
sure,
I would probably pick horror because I think that it's so filmic in the way that that horror often doesn't rely at all on dialogue or traditional sort of drama.
Yeah.
It relies so much on the technique and the tone and sound and
I'll
look
wait until
and light
you see
and
A Quiet
darkness.
Place.
I can't wait to see
that
A Quiet
Place. That is like excited. Exactly what you're explaining.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm really looking forward to seeing that.
I do. When I go see a horror movie, I'm always really, I have no doubt I'm going to love A Quiet Place, except when I'm watching it. And I'm like, this is exhausting to me. Like when I think about the kitchen sequence in Jurassic Park, I still like, it's been a long time since that movie came out. 25 years. I've seen that the kitchen sequence many times. And even now when I think about it, I'm like, okay, all right, I'm all right. I'm okay.
Like, the benefit of a movie that still holds up so many years later. My big memory for one particular scene was when I must have been like 6 or 7 when I saw that movie for the first time, which means my sister was even younger. I went with my parents, my sister, and 2 of my older cousins. We're all sitting there, and the moment that the T-Rex breaks out of its paddock, my sister just up and leaves, and she was out of there, and then my dad ran after her, and then by the time we hit the Brachiosaurus scene, I turn around, and you know how they have the little rectangle windows, or at least they used to, and there's her little face in the rectangle window, just watching from the back the entire time.
See,
she didn't like that.
Great. I know you're a Jurassic Park fan because you said paddock. You know,
I think I might know that entire movie word for word to the point where if I was good at mimicking things or anything like that, I could probably repeat the same exact type of dinosaur sounds too. It's like if someone changed the sound effect in that movie or even just like the tone to the slightest degree, I would pick up on it.
When they released Jaws on DVD, it was in 2000. It was a 25 year thing, and they made a couple of sound changes. Nothing big, but enough. One of them being when the boat is sinking, Quint's gone, Hooper's gone, and it's just Brody. And then the shark comes through the glass, and they changed, as far as I could tell, and I had seen the film many times by that point, they changed the sound of the glass, and I was not so much angry as just jarred. I was like, what did you do? Why did you do that? The movie won Best Sound. What are you doing fucking with it? I know what you mean.
I would have that same problem. I distinctly remember some of the Jurassic Park dinosaur roars are used in the were used in the show Falling Skies, and it used to drive me nuts. That show was pretty bad eventually anyway, but that in particular got me so crazy every time I watched it.
Because those those dinosaur sounds are pretty unique to Jurassic Park.
They're really unique. You want to know one sad story, though? So there was a period of time where my phone ring was just the classic T-Rex roar. And one time I was on the Tintin red carpet, and you guys probably know red carpets. You never get any time with the filmmakers at all. I was at the very, very end of it. For whatever reason, that was one of the first red carpets I had ever covered where the biggest guy there, Steven Spielberg, got there first, and he gave every single person on that carpet, even the dead last person, at least one question. And it's like, what am I going to do? What am I going to ask Steven Spielberg when I have maybe 15 seconds with him? So I had a little camera in my hand and I held up my phone and I'm like, do you know what this is? And I played him my T-Rex roar and he's like, and I shouted, I'm like, it's the roar from Jurassic Park. What's wrong? Oh yeah. So that's an interesting video that I wound up with after that experience. That's the only personal encounter I've had with Steven Spielberg.
Oh, that's fantastic. I'm going to tell a quick red carpet story that has nothing to do with working the red carpet. It has to do with when I worked at the Arclight as an usher and being handing out popcorn at the premiere of The Astronaut Farmer at the Cinerama Dome. And we could see from the inside there was someone. Because, yeah, the stars, like, don't show up until late, you know, and then, like, Billy Bob Thornton and Virginia Madsen showed up right before the movie, went in. As soon as the movie started, they left out the front door. But we could see from inside, like, there was someone working down and doing that. Like, we were like, who is that? Giving an interview to everyone. And in the end of the line, he turns and comes in, was Bill Nye the Science Guy. Apparently talking about the science of The Astronaut Farmer for, like, 2 hours. It was great.
That's so random.
Yeah. I've seen him on the subway, too, which is cool.
Oh.
Yeah.
I feel like I have seen him at some sort of press event before.
Yeah. But now this is like a New York thing, I guess. In New York, seeing a celebrity on the subway, that's still cool, but it's less like seeing a known person on the subway in Los Angeles is
seeing anyone on the subway.
Well, no, that's not true.
I know people.
It's always packed.
Yes.
I have yet to ride the subway out here.
What was that?
It's classist. When people say, oh, no one walks in L.A., it's like, no, you mean no rich white people walk in L.A.
Yeah.
Lots of our public transit system is packed. It's crowded all the time.
David, I'm doing very well. I don't need to take, I'm living in North Hills. We could go to, we three of us could go to a strip club right now. And if we don't like it, we go to the other one. It's no problem.
Yeah.
All right. I can't be riding subways.
That's the thing about Los Angeles. It wasn't what I was going to say, but the culture, I had a lot of culture shock coming. I'm from St. Louis, but I lived in Chicago before here. A lot of culture shock. But one thing about Los Angeles is that the strip clubs aren't like in like the industrial part of town. They're just like
right there.
Next to like, they're on the tourist. They're like on La Brea, you know, or on the Sunset Strip. You know, they're next to gas stations and just like, they're just there.
There are some in industrial areas.
Oh, yeah, I know.
I feel like I'm kind of numb to that because of New York. It's like, yeah, I never noticed this. I think it's because that's how it is in New York City, too.
Yeah, maybe coming from a place like St. Louis, it's like, you know, you don't advertise the strip club. It's, yeah. Anyway.
When I lived in Springfield, like, they had certain strip clubs, but, like, the one that everybody knew about is, outside of town a little bit. And it was called Illusions, and I was like, that's about right. I feel like that is maybe the most aptly titled strip club ever, right?
Yeah. All right, so let's go back to the horror thing, because I want to get into that. Like,
good segue.
At what age, like, did you realize you were like a horror fan specifically?
My experience that showed, I was watching horror movies when I was very, very young. It's like sometimes my parents would, I don't know, they would go out to a party or something and I would sleep over at my grandparents' place. And this is when I was super young, probably 7 and under. And at that point, you know, we would sit in their room and we would watch a horror movie before bed. And I remember watching Poltergeist with them. I mean, that's where I was basically exposed to some of the classics. Like, there's Poltergeist, The Exorcist, The Home and Rosemary's Baby, all that kind of stuff. But the one that made me realize that I was a horror...
Your grandparents weren't, like, showing you a Cannibal Holocaust.
No, no, that was not in the rotation. And even when I hit that part of the rotation much later on in life, that was one... Because I do have a line. Like, I'll watch just about anything, but the torture porn and the gratuity for the sake of blood and gore, that's where I'm like, I don't know if I need that in my life. And that's a very unpleasant movie that I'll probably never, ever revisit.
I've actually never seen it because I know there's like real animal torture and stuff. Yeah. Yeah, I don't need to see that.
I really can't handle that kind of stuff, but I actually think I watched it for some sort of article I wrote maybe like 7-8 years ago, and I just sucked it up and watched it, and I regretted it. That's actually how I felt about the movie Martyrs too.
Martyrs is
one movie that I was so put off by the end of it. Like, I walked around for a solid day or two after it just feeling like icky and gross and sad, and I don't like that in my horror movies.
Mm-hmm. That brings something up. Like, in reading Roger Ebert or watching like Siskel and Ebert, when they would talk about horror movies, you know, they weren't opposed to loving, they loved Halloween, they loved Texas Chainsaw Massacre, didn't have a lot of patience for like a lot of other slasher movies. And one of the things they talked about was the way it made them feel, and it just made them feel tired and depressed, and just like there was like, they felt like there was no joy of filmmaking. Mm-hmm. And so as a horror person, what do you find yourself wanting to feel when you're watching a horror movie?
I like the rush of feeling afraid, and I love the cinematic art of being able to craft a scare that will make you, I mean, even a jump scare that will make you jump in the theater, or something where it'll send you home. And I think a great recent example of this is Paranormal Activity. That's probably one of the first movies in a very, very long time that I would lay in bed at night and basically be staring out into the hallway, just waiting for a bathroom light to flip on.
Yeah.
I love that feeling. I love horror movies also as kind of escapism and just ways to feel these things that are never gonna, knock on wood, never ever gonna happen to you in your life.
Target. I don't know.
Okay. This is definitely not wood, but you know, the thought was there, so hopefully it counts. Yeah. But I just love the rush of going through something like that, and really I like that exhaustion feeling after, because you feel exhausted because it was, and I like rides too. It's probably connected. It's like you just went on this really intense ride. And then for me, that feeling at the end of it is like, oh, that was great. Right. And that is exactly how I felt at the end of A Quiet Place.
Yeah. Yeah. When I saw, when I was younger, I rather, elitistly, I look down on horror movies. Like, when I was a film, I feel like a lot of film people I know when they were younger just thought like, oh, horror movies, I know what those are all about. And then you realize, as David has said, like, well, there's also potential for tremendous style, maybe such that you can't find in any other film. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like only in the last probably 5, maybe 10 years have I started like really getting into horror, and it's so strange. Like, even like my favorite film of 2014 was The Babadook, which I adored, and that's not necessarily a fun horror movie, like, you know,
You're Next
or It Follows or something like that. But you know, I'm feeling engaged with the characters. I'm feeling at times very claustrophobic and suffocated because of how they're feeling. But I am engaged in a way that precisely because of the genre, because of the roller coaster, the up and down, and because we're dealing with often extreme imagery, the highs can be a little bit higher and then the drops can be a little bit further down than most genres. And yeah, by the end, like, yeah, you could be like, you know, out of breath, you could feel drained, but in the same way that, like, you know, if you go to a good comedy show or something like that and you laugh all night long, you're like, whew, That was great. I'm tired, but that was great.
The Babadook leaves you with something to think about, too, yes. Which is why I appreciate it. It's very much, it challenges you to kind of look at yourself and your own inner demons, and I appreciate it when I can carry things like that with me. But, you know, assessing the horror genre like that, it kind of is fair. I mean, I'll defend it to no end, and I'll watch some crappy horror movies, and I'll have fun with them where I can understand if other people don't. But really, especially in most of the 90s, the early 2000s, a lot of the genre, or at least studio-released horror movies where it was getting to the widest possible audience, was a lot of, like, rinse, wash, repeat. That's why we have so many classic slasher movies where their franchises are in the toilet and we're getting reboots of them because they drove those stories into the ground and largely just to make money. So I feel like that kind of negativity almost was earned by the industry, and I'm just so thankful that in recent years they're finally, and I credit Blumhouse a lot with this, because Blumhouse embraced the idea of taking risks by spending smaller amounts of money and letting the filmmakers do their thing. Not everything Blumhouse has released has been a hit, and I think the Purge franchise is a great example of a franchise that spiraled out of control a little bit, but they still, especially with the BH Tilt arm now, where they're doing even smaller movies with smaller releases, but they're doing all these really interesting things. Good on them, because I think that's why we're finding so many gems lately.
They're
I want to say real quick that the first Purge is my least favorite of the three Purges.
Third makes me sad. It's so bad.
I think the third one is better than the first one. The second one is the best. The second one is the movie that I wished the first one was while I was watching the
first
one.
I think that was the case with most viewers. I'm curious to see, I don't know when you run this, but as we're recording it, I think I'm hopeful we're going to get some Purge, first Purge content soon, because we've only got a super short teaser, but it is about time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I've seen none of them, but...
I don't know why, because you would dig it.
I think I would, but I really... Here's the thing. I haven't seen any of them, but every time... First off, their ad campaigns are always great, and then when the idea of, the first Purge, I'm especially interested in that. There's no guarantee I'm going to see it, I guess, but like the idea is like, the first Purge, that's got to be... There's potential for comedy in there of someone being like,
that is this new movie. Yeah. It's the first Purge, and it's genius. I was hoping that they would go down that route right after the first Purge movie came out. I'm like, you know, this is a really interesting concept. I want to know about the mentality behind it in order to make this thing happen. And you could approach it from so many angles. There's the comedy. There's the horror. Then it could also be a great political drama, because I would just love to be locked in a closed door room and just hear that discussion and whatever you need to pass that in order to make it happen. But I'm kind of hopeful with this, but if you've seen any of the marketing for this new movie, it is very on the nose with what they're going for. Yeah. And I wonder if that's going to take the fun of horror that I like out of it, the escapism I like out of it.
But that's, you know, I tend to be okay with like on the nose political commentary in horror, because part of me is like, well, I'd rather have it be here than in a drama, because at least there's stuff to distract me. And of course some of the trappings of horror can allow you to explore stuff in an even deeper way than drama.
I'm not done talking about The Purge.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Because I do think the third one has that comedy. The third one is this, the most of a most satire of, I think the entire existence of The Purge is satire. The third is the most satirical one, and I think we needed that second. The first one was so frustrating to me, because I was like, you've created this crazy idea and we have to spend the entire time in one house. I want to see the fucking mayhem. And that's what the second one was. But I'm nervous about the first Purge, because it's a different director. He's still the writer.
Yeah.
But I liked that we had a studio franchise that was a writer director franchise that he had made three in a row.
James DeMonaco is a smart, talented guy. He had so many. I remember talking to him for Purge Anarchy, and he had so many great ideas at the time. And then I think that's why I was so disappointed by the Purge election year. They talk about a movie that made me feel bad after. I just remember walking out of that screening mad because I was disappointed, but mad because of the behavior in that movie too. I don't think there's any more obnoxious character in the past, what is it, three, 4 years now, than the candy bar girl. who flips out and goes back to the convenience store because he wouldn't give her, and she just shouts about the candy bar. It was the most absurd thing I've ever seen.
But that's why it's so satisfying to see her and her friends get totally fucked up by the ambulance driver.
Well, yeah. That was the best part of that. Like that.
This is especially fun if you haven't seen it. And I'm not even being sarcastic. You're just like, candy bar girl and ambulance guy. Like,
ambulance lady.
Ambulance lady, pardon me.
No, there wasn't the ambulance lady.
Yeah, she was the one who...
And back to the candy bar girl, one of the most ridiculous things about that character and her friends was that their car was covered in Christmas lights. Uh-huh. Talk about a really easy way to open and close your car doors. It's like, how was that even set up?
I'm sorry. So, Tyler, you were going to ask Perry something that wasn't about The Purge.
I do not recall.
Because I could just talk about The Purge.
I was going to say is about Blumhouse. You know... When you're you know, a film fan and you're talking with other film fans, like, the thing that, especially, you know, if you're in your early 20s, all you ever do is, like, or at least I, is just, like, bemoan, like, ah, these studios with their big budgets, like, for the price of one big movie, you could make, like, 10 smaller movies, and just, like, and there's a company that's actually doing that. Now, it's within genre, and there's nothing wrong with that, but, like, it'd be awesome if they did that with just, you know, dramas in general, but, like, for them to embrace it and see how well it's paying off is really exciting. I hope more studios do it.
I do too. And that was always an idea that really bothered me, especially because, you know, think of a franchise like Transformers. Talk about, you know, I know some people out there have fun with them. I personally think they're garbage movies, and those movies have just astronomical budgets. Think about how many great little dramas we could get from one Transformers movie. And that whole concept hurt me even more after I tried to make my own feature. And just thinking how hard it was to make that itty bitty amount of money to try to bring to life a story that we had spent 5 years of our lives on, thought was so good. And then all of a sudden it's like you become a hot famous name in a studio, or you have a hot property. I mean, think about it. The emojis are super hot right now. Let's just throw money at that silly idea and make a buck off a movie. This is going to sound very childish, but that's not fair, and that's not right, and it shouldn't happen.
When I stepped off the bus here in Hollywood, they told me this is not what it's going to be.
Can you tell us anything about the movie you tried to make?
We made it.
Oh, you did make
Child Eater, that's what it's called. Child Eater is available on Amazon and some other platforms right now, and I'm really proud of it. It was probably one of the best experiences I've ever had in my entire life. The whole reason I went to film school is because I had gone a couple years critiquing other movies, and it hit this point where I said to myself, this doesn't feel right, and I think my reviews will be better if I know what this feels like and know what it takes. And that's why I went to film school. And then right after I got out of film school, one of the shorts we made got into South by Southwest, and we were so excited about that. And I was really close friends with the director that I worked on that one with. And we're like, you know what? Like, let's just do it. Let's turn this into a feature and give it a shot. And that's exactly what we did. And all of a sudden, one day came where we were able to get not even like most of the budget. It was like a good chunk of money, but it was still only a fraction of the budget. And our mentality was like, we have it. It's going to disappear if we don't go now. Right. So we did. We just kind of ripped the Band-Aid off and did it and swiped our credit cards for a couple of months, which was mortifying. But we made a movie, and a movie that, it's rough around the edges at certain points. I'll admit that. But I am so damn proud of that thing.
But I feel like horror fans are specifically forgiving of that. It's also, they're a passionate fan base.
I'm scrolling through the Amazon reviews and the star count.
Yeah, I guess that's true. People are pretty shitty.
It's rough to be on the other side that. And I mean, even just having switched from writing articles to being on YouTube and fielding those comments, it hurts. And sometimes you know that it's silly and you should compartmentalize and learn to ignore a certain subsection of them, but it's difficult. And it kind of makes me feel bad now a little when I review a movie super poorly. So I'll never lie and say I liked a movie to not hurt somebody's feelings. But I definitely, when I'm harsh on a movie, I choose my words carefully, respectfully, and honestly.
I was thinking just today if I'm too lenient on movies, because I was like thinking about various films that have come out in the last year or so that I'm like, I didn't hate that movie. I don't like it, but I didn't hate it. And like, and in my review, you can tell it's not so much that I'm hemming and hawing, but I am trying to find the positive where I can. And there, and part of me's like, am I just like an old softy? And it's like, I think it's probably better to like try to show people grace and the benefit of the doubt, given how hard, even in a studio situation, how hard it is to make a movie.
Most movies, even the worst ones out there, I mean, I'll go back to Transformers. Even Transformers has excellent visual effects. Just because I don't like the movie overall doesn't mean there's nothing good in it. And I'm also a firm believer of the fact that even though the large majority of people out there give every movie a negative, this one particular movie, let's say, a negative review, if it's got a 1 on Rotten Tomatoes, that still means that someone out there likes it. There's someone out there, that is a fan of every single movie ever made. So I try to always keep that in the back of my mind.
I like the idea that you find, like, there's the one review and it's all negative. It's like, there was a guy that looked kind of like my uncle in the scene, and I liked that.
I keep, since 2002, I've kept a list of every movie that I've seen that was released in that year, from my favorite to my least favorite. So I have a
list. Very impressive.
I have a list per year. But when I go back to before, like, we started this podcast in 2007, but we weren't really, like, I guess, critics, like, seeing a lot of movies and going to screens and stuff until like 2011 or so. And so when I go back and look at, like, I was so much more lenient when I wasn't seeing 300 something movies a year.
Sure.
Like even 10 years ago, it's like, yeah, I'm a Danny Boyle fan. I like Slumdog Millionaire, but it was like my number 5 of the year. There's like, there's no way I would be way too mean to Slumdog Millionaire if I saw it for the first time now. And so maybe I do need to step back, but I wanted to, you said something that really interested me about, feeling that your reviews would be better if you went to this experience. But I often wondered if sometimes there becomes a sort of like miss the forest for the trees type of element to people who have been through the trenches. Like maybe some critical distance is helpful.
I would say so. I don't know. I think no matter what your experience is, just either building yourself up as a critic, getting experience as a filmmaker, going off and doing another career and then coming back to it. I mean, we're all a product of our experiences and our environments, and we all have personal tastes. I mean, that's why it frustrates. I think one of the comments that bothers me the most on reviews that we post is when someone says, I don't trust you anymore because I didn't agree with you on this specific movie.
Right.
We don't have to agree on everything. Could you imagine if a critic out there was so strict and rigid, and they were so predictable with every single, and you knew every single time you were going to line up with them, that's not a human being. That's a two-dimensional writer. What's the point in that? And that's what makes film criticism so special, is that it's not a science. It's an art that's personal.
That's why I specifically seek out critics that I tend to not agree with. If they can write well, and they consistently make good cases for their opinions, even if they're consistently different than mine, that's my favorite type of critic to read.
Yeah,
I think it's, you know, different than mine is fine. I have to be vaguely sympathetic towards at least the way they are approaching film. Like, there are people, like, you and I don't agree on everything, David. We apparently agree on more than our listeners would like. Until the day we disagree, and then they're like, I don't like this at all. It's very uncomfortable. But
we need to fight more.
Okay.
Except not.
I don't think we do. What do you think of that?
I think because you and I are scared now because our fight over The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which has now been 6 years or something, got so personal that I think we have maybe we need to wade back into those waters of being willing to to fight each other.
Clearly, we'll have to listen to that episode.
It's still out there. We have not taken it down.
I don't agree with you on everything, but I can see the way you approach movies and giving them, you know, I know that you give them the benefit of the doubt. You try to see what the filmmaker was attempting and all that sort of thing. You don't insist that a movie just cater to you. And then there are plenty of people, even actual critics or professional or semi-professional critics that I read. And I'm just like, you came in with a very specific idea of what you wanted. and we all do, but you seemed unable or unwilling to drop it when the film quickly became something else. And it's something that exhausts me, and that's when I tend to that's when I get to a point where I'm like, I don't trust this person anymore.
Yeah, that's a sad situation to be stuck in. And I understand that happens to a degree where you can't help it, just because, I mean, it doesn't even matter with internet. And, you know, because we're talking about that a lot lately with Last Jedi, and how Last Jedi, you come up with all these predictions, and then basically Rian Johnson, like, poo-poos your predictions and you're pissed about it. But even without the internet culture, it's just human nature to go into a movie or into any kind of experience, any book, any TV show with expectations. And it can be difficult to process it when those expectations aren't met. But that is the most exciting thing about cinema to me. I want my expectations to be surpassed and subverted in ways that I didn't expect. And maybe things that make me feel funny about what I'm watching and enjoying. But as long as it's a surprise and it's a justified one, great.
I feel like a lot of people, at least in some of the circles that I've run in, it's like the question of why never comes up. It's only that, like, this did that, and I don't like it. And it's like, okay, but why did it do that? If it subverted expectations, like, well, that's a big deal. It's always a big deal, especially something like Last Jedi, which subverted entire, you know, hanging threads and plot lines and that sort of thing. So, like, to me, there are so many people in that instance that were just mad at the very fact of it, that they didn't take the time to ask why Rian Johnson would do that. Maybe they ask it just long enough, and they're like, he just did it to piss us off. It's like, yeah, I'm sure that's it.
Yeah.
He did it because he hates Star Wars. Yep, undoubtedly. That's why people make movies. That's why people devote 2 years of their life to making a movie. Is like, I'm going to get this franchise that's going to make my career. But anyway.
Yeah, that's like an Andy Kaufman level committing to the bit at that point. But, you know, it's funny. I was when you were talking about subverting expectations, and you guys are talking about Star Wars fans not liking that. And I guess that's certainly with Collider and even with Battleship Retention. Like, our audiences are people who tend to watch it. Ton of movies and have these kind of opinions, but I wonder if you're, you know, a sort of, if you're writing for, I don't know, the Times or whatever, whichever Times, whatever, like, mainstream publication, where, like, you're not assuming that your readership is someone who goes to the movies multiple times a week. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's a different, like, you know, we movie people here get mad when a trailer gives too much away, right?
Sure.
But the average moviegoer wants that. The average moviegoer is saying, I'm going to go see 5 or 6 movies a year.
Yeah.
It's going to cost me and my family $60. I want to know what I'm getting, which is, you know, why the mainstream people hated Cabin in the Woods. Woods is the worst movie for the 5-time-a-year moviegoer, because that's the person who wants to know exactly what they're going to see.
Oh, I love that movie. I love that movie so much. I think about it a lot with spoilers, though, because obviously we're talking about movies day and night. And, you know, Last Jedi, for example, if all of a sudden you're on a live show and you blurt out a big fat spoiler for Last Jedi, it's difficult, because is it right or wrong? As a movie channel that covers this stuff constantly, there needs to be a line where we could talk about it freely. Otherwise, we can't further our conversations along. Yeah. But there is a significant amount of people who, maybe not even by choice, just can only afford 5 or 6 movie ticket prices are absolutely insane. Yeah. Maybe they want to save their money and not go to see it in the theater, and instead just buy it and own it when it comes out on Blu-ray. So I'm just constantly thinking, you know, how much should I actually censor myself with spoilers? And I think I've gone to a little bit of an extreme with that, but it's with that idea in mind that really most people out there, maybe not necessarily the core audience that watches our shows, but so many people out there really don't. I mean, I see 2-3 movies a week. I don't think there's very many people who do that.
Yeah.
And I do think that there is, I won't even talk about, like, the idea of, like, time, you know, like, after a certain point, we shouldn't worry about spoilers anymore. I'm putting that aside. But just the sheer number of things that people consider spoilers. Like, when I wrote my review for Blade Runner 2049, I mention in my plot synopsis, which I tried to keep pretty vague, I mentioned that Ryan Gosling is a replicant, which is established about a scene and a half in, maybe two scenes in. And I was like, I recognize that that could be a spoiler as far as the marketing. But as far as the movie, I don't think it's treated as a huge twist. It's just treated as a reveal and just part of who the character is. And there were people that got upset with me for that. I don't know. Do you think that would qualify as a spoiler?
That doesn't surprise me. What I tend to do in order to shield myself from divulging anything that's a spoiler is I'll read the official synopsis and I'll watch the trailer. Sure. And if something is in there, then it's fair game in my mind. But just recently we reviewed the movie Blockers and I said something like, oh, it's about three parents who try to stop I misphrased it. And I said, it's about three parents who stop their three teenage daughters from enacting a sex pact on prom. And they're like, well, now I don't have to see the movie. And I'm like, whoa.
I even heard of opinion, like say Tyler, we're finally gonna watch Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and I say like, oh, wait till you get to, you know, season 2 episode 17 or whatever, and he'd be like, dude, like, you know. Yeah. I've even seen that kind of reaction.
I have someone in the office who does that too. The movie that I was talking about is escaping me. Oh no, I remember what it is. It was Jigsaw. I figured you didn't see Jigsaw. In Jigsaw, I mean, all right, here we go. Spoiler alert for Jigsaw, if you care about this. Jigsaw,
which listeners can find on the 10 worst movies of 2017.
That's right.
For Battleship Retention. But yes, by all means, I'm sorry, go on.
Jigsaw was very disappointing, but it did something pretty clever at the end. And in order to give the movie credit, I was not going to let that whole review go by and not praise them for taking that risk and surprising me with a nice, and I used the word twist. And the person who was editing that review for me was like, well, now I know there's a twist that's not okay. And I'm like, whoa. It's frustrating because it feels like that's too much, but I also see his point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I've gotten to a place where I'm just okay with spoilers now. You know, I don't seek them out, but I just I've realized that the anxiety of trying to avoid them is usually not worth whatever I think I'm preserving.
You can't do what we do and completely avoid spoilers.
Right. Yeah.
Because really, how many news stories do we cover regularly where it's like so-and-so rumor of so-and-so plot point, and you don't really know until the movie comes out if it was true or not. But there's tons of rumors that I've covered that turned out to be major plot spoilers in movies.
One of the things that my friend and I were talking about when studios successfully keep secrets. It's very rare. And one of them didn't even happen to me. It happened to David when he went to see, and maybe you saw it as well, The Woods.
Oh,
which
yeah.
Which was then revealed to be Blair
Someone
Witch.
Someone spoiled that for me.
Did they?
Yeah. I saw that at Comic-Con,
yeah,
I guess two years ago. And before I went to that screening, someone told me what it was.
Oh. Well, it was very cool.
That one, yeah.
For the listeners, and I mean, Perry, you were there, but you obviously didn't get. So they walked us in, mm-hmm. and the theater had a huge, like, light up, like, standee that said The Woods, right?
Mm. People wearing shirts, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and everything said The Woods, and then you watch the movie, and the title isn't. The main title is at the end, so like you're watching the whole movie, and it's sort of dawning on you, like, oh shit, this is like. At first, I was like, oh, this is a sort of Blair Witch homage, and then I realized, no, I'm watching a Blair Witch movie, and at the end it says Blair Witch, and then you walk out, they've all changed their shirts to Blair Witch, and that big light up sign now says Blair Witch. It was very, very cool.
Even though I knew what was happening, it was still a very clever marketing tactic.
Yeah.
That sadly didn't do anything for the movie because it didn't do very well.
Yeah, and that's like making a splash at Comic-Con. Clearly, it didn't work for Scott Pilgrim. It didn't work for The Woods.
It didn't work for Dread either.
Right.
It didn't work for Dread. I'm just thinking about all the movies. It didn't work for Death Note. It didn't work for Project Almanac. So it didn't work for Cowboys and Aliens. Maybe it didn't work for Star Trek Beyond. Don't screen your movie at San Diego Comic-Con. I mean, screen it for me because I just want to see it. But clearly, it's not going to help your movie at the box office.
Yeah. What's this, sorry, what's this look
was,
on your face,
I was,
Tyler?
I was thinking about, it's fine, it's fine. We can.
You're thinking about Project Almanac?
always. I was hoping someone would mention it. I don't even remember what that is. What is Project Almanac?
Project Almanac was the time-traveling found footage movie that Dean Israelite directed before he did Power Rangers.
Oh.
It's actually, it's I had fun with it. It's pretty good. It's not okay. The greatest thing in the world, but I think many gave it a very hard time right out the gate for it being a found footage style movie or a shaky cam style movie and just, you know, kind of didn't give it a chance.
I feel like any style can be neutral, I think. I mean, yes, I understand if it's right in the middle and it's just like, okay, it's just one thing after another. But to me, like Chronicle, I think, is a pretty good use of found footage. Every once in a while, yeah, they stretch it a bit to accommodate it. But for the most part, and yeah, could it have worked as just a straightforward narrative? Probably. But by doing this, it adds an interesting element. And yeah, like with any genre or style, like all it takes is one movie to do it really well. And then you're like, oh, yeah, now I remember.
But that's the thing. Like, it's easy to say in retrospect, but when there's a glut of a certain type of thing, I would try not to. I think I would still want to try to. I never saw Project Almanac. I would have wanted to give it a chance, but I could understand being sort of reflexively like fed up. You know, I remember back when Mad Men was on and then Jon Hamm would keep showing up on like 30 Comedy Rock stuff, or yeah. like Tim and Eric or like Children's Hospital or whatever. I don't know if he did a Tim and Eric, but like that kind of stuff. At a certain point, it was like, fuck, I get it. Jon Hamm's funny. I'm over the novelty of Jon Hamm being funny. Yeah. Now, if I went back and watched those Children's Hospital episodes now, I'd be like, oh yeah, that was funny. But at the time, I was like, give me a break.
I think the word novelty is what I'm latching on to there, is that he's doing good work in those things. Mm-hmm. And so it's something that like, but it's treated as a novelty. It's like, okay, well, once we get over the novelty, then we can actually look back and see if there was anything of merit there. And so I think with something like found footage, it's been around long enough, and there have been enough good movies within that, that I think we can say like, yeah, okay, the novelty has certainly worn off, but like anything else, there are good movies and there are good examples and bad examples. I'm a big fan of The Bay. Did you ever see The Bay?
I did see The Bay. I remember that. Who directed
Barry
that?
Barry Levinson.
Yeah, Barry Levinson. I covered that at a New York Comic Con, actually, one year.
I didn't know what to expect. I was like, okay, Barry Levinson making a found footage. Let's give it a shot. And I thought it was great. And I thought it was a great use of found footage that, like, one of the characters has specifically found this footage so that she can assemble it. And I thought, like, yeah, okay, that's helpful. Because a big question for me with any of these movies, like, boy, this sure does work out well. Like, they really capture every part of the narrative, don't they? That's really something.
That's always the thing, too, is justifying it.
Yeah.
Justifying someone running around and holding a camera in their hand the entire time.
Which has become easier now that we're all, like, constant reflexive self-documentarians. Mm. Like, found footage movies now can have so many different camera angles, like I mean, Blair Witch did that, but also what was in the second VHS?
VHS 2 is fantastic.
Well, okay, I know every single one. Gareth Evans, right?
Yeah, that's the best
one.
The first one's really good. It's camera through an eye implant, which was very clever. The second one is the helmet cam. Ride in a Park, great short. And then the third one is Safe Haven, and that's done documentary style. And then the fourth is just Alien Abduction Slumber Party. It's from Jason Eisner, right. And it's just kids with a handheld camera. And at one point, it becomes a dog camera, and they strap it on the dog.
That's right.
Really, just four great examples of really well-done found footage with a crappy wraparound to stitch them all together. That was one thing that I haven't really seen. I actually can't think of a single horror anthology that does a good wraparound segment that brings it all together.
Yeah, that's a good that would be a good challenge for the listeners, see if they can come up with one.
Oh, I've got one.
But real quick, the thing I was going to say about Safe Haven is that there's like 20 different cameras in it, because they each have like two cam. They have like a body cam, mm-hmm. and they're carrying cam, and there's security footage all over the cult compound.
Safe Haven is nuts.
It's so cool. Did you ever see it?
I didn't. I haven't seen any of the VHS.
That might be one of the best short films I've ever seen in my life.
Hmm. right.
I was shocked by that. I like all four of them, but I must have gone back and rewatched. Yeah. I own VHS too, and I just fast forward to Safe Haven a lot. Yeah. Because it's incredible.
It's so cool.
Was it called The Sacrament?
Oh God,
that's like another cult one.
That was Ty West.
Ty West, yeah. That's right. Yes,
which
you didn't care for, right?
Yeah, starring a friend of the show, AJ Bowen.
Yeah,
but that was a dreadful movie. Mm.
That's unfortunate because the story sounded so good, and that actor who plays like the cult leader is an actor. Right. I've enjoyed him in other things.
Yeah, he's the gas station owner from No Country for Old Men. Yeah, yeah.
He's
great.
He's Sweet Dave in The Hateful Eight.
Oh, yep. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Talk about an unpleasant movie.
The Sacrament.
Yeah. That was one of those movies where, I mean, you know, there wasn't anything that bad about it. I thought it was pretty well done, but I walked away feeling just bummed and like I had no fun whatsoever in that.
Yeah. And it does seem if you're going to make something that's so heavily influenced by an actual event, like... do something with it. Like, it felt kind of especially exploitative. Yeah.
American Horror Story this season tried to do something with that, and you know, I don't really think that they nailed it, but there's some really creative flair to it. I mean, really, the whole thing with how they approached the election, I was very nervous about that at the very beginning, because the first episode of that season feels extremely and obnoxiously heavy-handed, and you think you know exactly the path it's going to go down, and then it starts to play around with certain things that don't necessarily even tie into the election. It's a lot of true crime that they reenact, and some of that stuff was done in a pretty clever manner, and even though it's an extreme version of just the cult mentality and how someone can be manipulated by a bigger idea or a more manipulative, powerful person, it was done in a way that kind of got the wheels in your head turning, and it made you understand both perspectives a little more, which I kind of appreciated in the end.
I haven't watched American Horror Story since Freak Show, and I didn't want to watch because, like you're talking about the pilot, I was like, I'm not ready for this to be entertainment yet.
That was exactly what I said at the end of that episode, because I had already committed for my own channel, just because I've watched American Horror Story since day one, and I've covered it since day one, and I said, I'm reviewing episode one of this season right now, and I'm going to do it every single week until the end. So I was committed no matter what. But when I finished episode one, I said to myself off camera, like, what did I get myself into? I'm going to be miserable doing this. But by episode three and four, they really got into a surprisingly unique groove.
That is kind of how I felt about Hannibal, which I think is an astonishing show. But as I've said, it's a show that, not that it was released on Netflix or anything, but when I caught up with it, you know, a bunch of episodes were available online. And so I watched a bunch of episodes in a row, and immediately I was like, I can't do that. This is not a bingeable show.
No, it's really not.
Like, not merely because of the imagery, but just the tone and the emotion is just so, again, it's gorgeous. It's a really wonderful, meaningful show, but it's just so, everything is just so thick. And I'm like, maybe two episodes in a row. Maybe. If I do three, like, I need a nap for like 12 hours.
I love Hannibal. Like, as I've said, as I alluded to earlier, Buffy the Vampire Slayer has always been my favorite TV show, but I think I need, it's as much as it's hard for me to say, Hannibal might be better. That's how much I loved Hannibal.
I got through two seasons of Hannibal, and then I think I stopped just for work reasons. Something else became the priority, and I never went back to it, but I've always been meaning to go back and just watch it all.
There's a lot of good stuff in that third season.
It's also one of the rare shows that ended before it was intended to, but that the third season finale really works as a series finale.
Yeah.
Like, people say that about other stuff, I think just to, like, make themselves feel better, but it, like, honestly, I spent the whole third season going, God, I hope Amazon or Netflix or someone picks us up. And then I watched the third season finale and I was like, you know what? Leave it. Like, this is actually kind of perfect.
You know, it's a really good horror show that's on that you guys would probably like. I mean, it's not really directly connected to Hannibal, but it's just that kind of really thoughtful, character-driven, heavy-style horror. And it's actually on Sci-Fi. Nobody's watching it, and I keep pumping it because I think it's so, so good, is Channel Zero. Have you ever heard of Channel Zero?
Oh, I know the image of the teeth kid or whatever.
That was season one. So each season is based on a different creepypasta.
Oh, okay.
And they've done some incredible things. The first one was Candle Cove, and it's great. That's the one with the teeth monster. The second one, which is my favorite, I haven't finished the third, which is Butcher's Block, but the second one, No End House, is incredible. John Carroll Lynch is in that, and obviously he is great in everything, so it's going to be no surprise that he is just so he strikes such a weird balance between, because he plays one of the characters' fathers, fatherly but chilling, and really everything in that season was great.
I was going to warn Tyler not to look up
the tooth monster.
It's horrible. And,
That's going to stay with me.
Well, we should start thinking about wrapping up, but you've talked about video a couple times. I mentioned your title as, I've already forgot what it is, Collider Video Senior Editorial Producer.
I always have to think about it, and people ask me all the time, and I'm like, Senior Editorial Producer.
So, talk about what you do at Collider.
What don't I do at Collider right now? A little of everything, and I'm actually really lucky that I do a little of everything. It makes the days really busy, but I still write for Collider.com a little bit. I just wrote a feature on Ready Player One, the book first film idea, and I love writing still, but definitely I am very drawn to the idea of expressing my opinions and talking about movies on camera, on the YouTube channel, in that community so much. So I do appear on a lot of the shows that we do, but mainly behind the scenes, what my job is right now is producing in every single capacity imaginable, whether it's show running one particular show or just working on bigger picture type products that really affects the brand overall. So I've had my hand in so many different things that, especially thinking back to when I first started doing movie blogging, when all of these outlets were owned independently, I'll never forget. There was one person who I would look at and say, like, when I get to your level, I'm going to be successful. Like, I'm going to feel good about where I am. And the fact that I've so far surpassed that is astounding to me, what this industry has grown into, and it's so exciting to be a part of it.
Well,
someday we'll get there, David.
I enjoy doing this as a side gig. I really like my job. But the listeners will never know what my job is.
That's right.
Anyway, this has been a blast. We should definitely have you on again.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
this was a pleasure.
We barely scratched the surface. You listeners, you know, you can find us at BattleshipRetention.com. This year you can find all sorts of movie reviews. I'm trying to think what I just posted my review of You Were Never Really Here. I'm in the minority. Didn't care much for it. Did you see it?
I didn't see that one.
Okay.
I need to.
Lynn Ramsey.
Yeah.
I like Lynn Ramsey. And it was going for a while, but I think the third act just grew tedious to me. But you can check out the review. Also, my review of Lean on Pete, which is a great movie.
That I really want to say.
It's really good. But yeah, you know, bring some tissues. It's a tearjerker. Anyway, that's all at BattleshipRetention.com. You can email us at David@BattleshipRetention.com or Tyler@BattleshipRetention.com. You can follow us on Twitter at DavyPretension, at TylerPretension. Your other podcast, Tyler, More Than One Lesson, is back.
It is.
Is it back to stay? Back in full force?
Yes, I would say so. I can't guarantee there will be an episode every week, but there will be for the foreseeable future.
And morethanonelesson.com is where you find that.
Black Panther. We're talking about Black Panther this week.
Fantastic. So that's that. Perry, where can people find you?
Oh, all over the place. At P. Nemiroff on Twitter and Instagram, on the Collider Video YouTube channel, of course. And then you can also check out my own YouTube channel, where there's lots of Channel Zero coverage.
Fantastic.
All right.
Check out all the teeth monsters.
Boy,
you can handle.
I do regret looking that up.
All right. Thanks again for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you at home for listening.
We'll get you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.